It's an ongoing conversation between classic Catholicism and contemporary culture. Your watering hole on the path from sanity to sanctity. Serving up a daily mix of truth, beauty, and goodness. It's Happy Hour with Matthew Arnold.
Welcome. Welcome to the Happy Hour. Glad to have you along with us. Matthew Arnold here, and hoping that I am on the air as I speak. Here we am. Here I am. Okay. Can you hear me, Richie? Okay, good. All right. We are experiencing a somewhat larger than normal volume of technical things. We actually just this weekend, over the three-day weekend, and I want to say thanks to Richie and to the other guys that that helped put this together. Terry was in over the weekend, and their wives for letting them be here instead of enjoying the holiday with their family. Also, my own wife for taking care of the website over the weekend and getting everything up to speed for the launch of the new studio here. We are in Studio B. Studio A still looks like a bombed out shell of its former self, but we do have some great stuff going on here, and please bear with us as we fix all of the glitches as we move along here. And also, we're going to get something in this room to cut the echo down also. We get something besides the four bare walls in here in the next day or so, I hope. Got a lot of stuff to talk about. I got to say, first up, I can't say how happy I am living in these times and how encouraged I am by you. And to tell you, always remember that no matter what happens, always remember that from all eternity, God decided that this is exactly the right time for you to know, love, and serve him in this world, and that he made you to be happy with him forever in the next, and that the challenge of our day is precisely our challenge. Now, this Saturday, September the 1st, was the 108th anniversary of the institution of the Oath Against Modernism. And by the way, we sent out an email with a typo that said 58th anniversary, but it's actually been 51 years since it was abolished. But anyway, as promised, we put the oath up on vmpr.org, the Virgin Most Powerful Radio website, and many of you, dozens and dozens of people, have already taken the oath, and so I thank you for that, and if you haven't done it yet, I encourage you to do so. And when you take that oath online at vmpr.org, it will generate a personalized PDF that you can print out, and it will also be generating a list, and your name will be included on that list that Terry and Jesse will take with them to the upcoming Bishops' Conference. And you might be wondering, okay, what's the point? Obviously, the Oath Against Modernism was mandated for clergy and religious and professors of theology and philosophy in the seminaries, and not for regular rank-and-file lay people. But we have introduced this initiative to get lay Catholics to voluntarily take the oath in order to demonstrate to the powers that be that lay Catholics still take their faith seriously, that lay Catholics are not too sophisticated to believe what Catholics have always believed, that lay Catholics today understand that modernism is still a heresy and that heresy will still send you to hell, whether you believe in hell or not. And so, with your kind indulgence, I'm going to just right here at the get-go fulfill my promise to take the Oath Against Modernism on the air. And here we go. I, Matthew Arnold, firmly embrace and accept each and every definition that has been set forth and declared by the unerring teaching authority of the Church, especially those principal truths which are directly opposed to the errors of this day. And, first of all, I profess that God, the origin and end of all things, can be known with certainty by the natural light of reason from the created world, that is, from the visible works of creation as a cause from its effects, and that therefore his existence can also be demonstrated. Secondly, I accept and acknowledge the external proofs of revelation, that is, divine acts and especially miracles and prophecies, as the surest signs of the divine origin of the Christian religion. And I hold that these same proofs are well adapted to the understanding of all eras and all men, even of this time. Thirdly, I believe with equally firm faith that the Church, guardian and teacher of the revealed word, was personally instituted by the real and historical Christ when he lived among us, and that the Church was built upon Peter, the prince of the apostolic hierarchy, and his successors for the duration of time. Fourthly, I sincerely hold that the doctrine of faith was handed down to us from the apostles through the Orthodox fathers in exactly the same meaning and always in the same purport. Therefore, I entirely reject the heretical misrepresentation that dogmas evolve and change from one meaning to another, different from the one which the Church held previously. I also condemn every error according to which, in place of the divine deposit which has been given to the spouse of Christ to be carefully guarded by her, there is put a philosophical figment or product of a human conscience that has gradually been developed by human effort and will continue to develop indefinitely. Fifthly, I hold with certainty and sincerely confess that faith is not a blind sentiment of religion welling up from the depths of the subconscious under the impulse of the heart and the motion of a will trained to morality. But faith is a genuine assent of the intellect to truth received by hearing from an external source. By this assent, because of the authority of the supremely truthful God, we believe to be true that which has been revealed and attested to by a personal God, our Creator and Lord. Furthermore, with due reverence, I submit and adhere my whole heart to the condemnations, declarations, and all the prescripts contained in the encyclical Pascendi and in the Decree Lamentabili, especially those concerning what is known as the history of dogmas. I also reject the error of those who say that the faith held by the Church can contradict history, and that Catholic dogmas, in the sense in which they are now understood, are irreconcilable with a more realistic view of the origins of the Christian religion. I also condemn and reject the opinion of those who say that a well-educated Christian assumes a dual personality, that of a believer and an historian, as if it were permissible for an historian to hold things that contradict the faith of the believer, or to establish premises which, provided there be no direct denial of dogmas, would lead to the conclusion that dogmas are either false or doubtful. Likewise, I reject that method of judging and interpreting sacred scriptures, which, departing from the tradition of the Church, the analogy of faith, and the norms of the Apostolic See, embraces the misrepresentations of the rationalists, and with no prudence or restraint, adopts textual criticism as the one and supreme norm. Furthermore, I reject the opinion of those who hold that a professor lecturing or writing on a historico-theological subject should first put aside any preconceived opinion about the supernatural origin of Catholic tradition, or about the divine promise to help to preserve all revealed truth forever, and that they should then interpret the writings of each of the fathers solely by scientific principles, excluding all sacred authority and with the same liberty of judgment that is common to the investigation of all ordinary historical documents. Finally, I declare that I am completely opposed to the error of the modernists who hold that there is nothing divine in sacred tradition, or what is far worse, say that there is, but in a pantheistic sense, with the result that there would remain nothing but this plain simple fact, one to be put on a par with the ordinary facts of history, the fact, namely, that a group of men, by their own labor, skill, and talent, have continued through subsequent ages a school begun by Christ and his apostles. I firmly hold, then, and shall hold to my dying breath, the belief of the fathers in the charism of truth, which certainly is, was, and always will be in the succession of the episcopacy from the apostles. The purpose of this, then, not that dogma may be tailored according to what seems better and more suited to the culture of each age, rather, that the absolute and immutable truth preached by the apostles from the beginning may never be believed to be different, may never be understood in any other way. I promise that I shall keep all these articles faithfully, entirely, and sincerely, and guard them inviolate, in no way deviating from them in teaching or in any way in word or in writing. Thus I promise, this I swear, so help me God. There it is. And notice what the oath does not say. It does not say that our understanding of doctrines cannot deepen. It says the meaning of dogmas cannot change from one meaning to another different meaning. The oath does not forbid the textual or historical critical study of Scripture, but asserts that Catholic Scripture scholarship must take place within the context of the faith and not as if the inspired authors require or are subject to correction from modern scholars. Jesus compared the Church to a tiny seed that grows into the greatest of plants. The oath does not deny this at all, but powerfully reminds us that there is such a thing as absolute and immutable truth. In other words, truth doesn't change with our circumstances because Jesus Christ is the way and the truth and the life. And whatever happens in the world, he does not change. Jesus Christ, yesterday and today, and the same forever. That's Hebrews 13:8. Amen. Now, I hope that you'll visit vmpr.org and join us in pledging your unending fidelity to the truth and your perseverance against the synthesis of all heresies. All right, lots of good stuff to talk about today, as always. Going to talk about honor, and especially the honor of God, and also how the scandal of the clerical abuse, clerical sexual abuse, proceeds from clerical liturgical abuse. And we're going to share some good news also about the good bishops who are stepping up in this current crisis and how we need to support them. Because, you know, it was only a matter of time. For years and years now, when my fellow Catholics, especially fellow apologists and evangelists, people in lay apostolate, when they would complain or, shall we say, raise concerns about the scandalous behavior or the scandalous statements of various bishops and priests, I would always ask, why is Rome silent? And I was given various assurances about how the Pope doesn't know, or, you know, the Pope doesn't believe that, or he actually wrote an encyclical against that, but the bishops aren't listening, and so on. And so we know the Pope doesn't approve, but there's really nothing he can do about it, and so on. And at some point, I started stating the obvious, that there would come a time when one of these very bishops that you complain about, ordained and formed in the post-Vatican II milieu, and completely on board with the spirit of Vatican II, is going to become Pope. And we'll talk about that and lots more when we come back with Happy Hour on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. Matthew Arnold here, host of Happy Hour on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. Part of our daily schedule of live 100% Catholic programs, along with the Terry and Jesse Show and the Bar of History with Dr. Ed Mazza. It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. This fall, Virgin Most Powerful Radio will be rolling out another original live program, Jesus 911 with Jesse Romero, Eddie Chavez, and Ruben Nava. Three ex-cops sharing true stories of evangelization and spiritual warfare on the streets of Los Angeles. We're also remodeling our studio and preparing to launch our new website and smartphone app. We desperately need to fix the bugs so you can listen live on our app or YouTube without any glitches. Plus, meet traditional broadcast standards in order to provide our exclusive programming to Catholic radio stations around the country and around the world, absolutely free of charge. As usual, we're doing it all on a shoestring budget, but we cannot do it without you. If you like what you hear on Virgin Most Powerful, I ask you to please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org. This October 13th, we invite you to Virgin Most Powerful's Call to Holiness Conference, Serious Scandals, Spiritual Solutions, at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina. Join Catholic authors and VMPR hosts Matthew Arnold, Dr. Ed Mazza, and Terry Barber to discover how you and your family can navigate the current crisis in the Church with your faith not only intact, but stronger than ever before. Visit vmpr.org to register online now.
Welcome back to the Terry and Jesse Show. To join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Now, here's Terry and Jesse.
Okay, I'm not actually Terry and Jesse, but I do play them on TV. Yes, like I was saying, they're still dealing with the glitches. And you know what? I urge you to be patient and to be forgiving, because it was an Herculean effort put in by a very small group of people over a holiday weekend to get us moved in to this new studio. Even though things only moved about 12 feet, there's hundreds of miles of wire and so forth, some of which have become crossed, apparently. And so we're going to work that out, please God. And, you know, with your continued prayers and support. But I was talking before the break about how I used to always talk about the inevitability that the kind of bishops that people complain about are eventually going to be in charge of the church. You know, we're going to run out of guys who were formed and ordained prior to the council and prior to modernism becoming so rampant in the church. And it's just a fact of history. And we're seeing it, you know, the results of it now. And I could see it coming. I remember, and I've been Catholic for 20-some years now, and the Easter after I came into the church, a choir director at our parish asked me if I would participate in the washing of the feet on Holy Thursday. And I didn't really consider myself worthy, and I hadn't been Catholic very long, and I said, golly, I don't know if I want to do that. And she said that she was having trouble. It had to be 12 men, and she was having trouble getting that many. And I thought, well, that's kind of sad, but okay. If it's necessary, I will do it. And I participated on the Holy Thursday, had my feet washed by the parish priest, and everything was swell. And then the next year, she approached me again, and I said yes again. But this time, apparently, they had even more trouble, because it wasn't 12 men. There were women up on the in the sanctuary, and even a couple little kids. And I thought, you know, as far as I know, the rubrics haven't changed. So, you know, what the heck? Are you just, you know, honestly, there was more than a dozen men in the congregation. The church was pretty full. And so I wondered about it, and I did some research. And of course, washing of feet was customary in the ancient world. People wore sandals. They walked around. Their feet got dirty. When you went into someone's home, it was customary for them to have a servant come and wash your feet. In fact, it was the work of the lowest servant in the house, or even technically the work of a slave. That's why we have John the Baptist. When our Lord came to him and said, can you, you know, I need you to baptize me, to bathe him. Baptize means to bathe. And St. John the Baptist says, you know, I need to be baptized by you. And he said that he was not worthy even to bend down and unloose the strap of his sandal. In other words, he wasn't worthy to baptize him. He wasn't even worthy to wash his feet. In fact, he wasn't even worthy to take his shoes off. And it goes back to that custom of washing the feet. And that's why Peter, on the first Holy Thursday, was so scandalized when Jesus put the towel around him and got up the basin and said he was going to wash the feet of the apostles. Peter's like, never are you going to wash my feet. Because it was wrong for him to do, in Peter's eyes, for Jesus to do something that it was normally done by a slave. And then, of course, Jesus said, in that context, I give you a new commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. And he says that if you want to lead, you have to be the servants of all. And so over the years, it became customary for the heads of religious orders, for example, to wash the feet of their inferiors. And even royalty would wash the feet of the poor. You know, even in Hungary and in Spain, Austria-Hungary and in Spain, that custom lasted into the 20th century. And by the 12th century, you had the popes in Rome washing the feet of 12 subdeacons on Holy Thursday. But it was always done outside of Mass. And that's why Holy Thursday, though, was called Maundy Thursday, if you've ever heard that expression. It's an old English nickname for Holy Thursday. It was called Maundy after the Latin Mandatum Novum Do Vobis. I give to you a new commandment. And, you know, the washing the feet and all that was done in that context. Now, it wasn't included in the Mass until the 1955 revision of Holy Week under Pope Pius XII, and the main architect of which was a certain Annibale Bonini, and that's a whole other story for a whole other time, so I'm not going to digress. But you have now clearly you've got a liturgical action that is symbolic of Christ and the apostles. So that's why the Pope washed the feet of 12 ordained men. And then when it was extended to common bishops and priests, they were to wash the feet of 12 men, because it represents, you know, the priest in persona Christi, and then the faithful representing the apostles. And at some point in the 60s or the 70s, the liturgists decided that it was about the clergy serving the laity. And that, of course, eventually led to including women and children, because they're part of the laity, too. After all, they're the church, too. So the symbolism of it is lost. And, of course, all of that was done without any kind of permission and without any reproof. I don't recall anybody getting any nasty grams from the local bishop or from the Holy See. So when you roll around to the Holy Thursday of 2013, and Pope Francis not only washes the feet of lay people, but the feet of women and even non-Christians, even a Muslim woman, right? It caused something of a tempest in a teapot in the press. But I was not surprised by this. After all, he's only doing what bishops and priests have been doing for decades and preaching about and teaching about in adult formation classes and so forth without correction. And the only reason it was news, I think, is so that we could have another look how progressive Pope Francis's story in the media. But I can't begin to understand how any Catholic could have been shocked by this. It was only a matter of time. You know, last week I quoted Monsignor Fenton, who was one of the most respected Catholic theologians in the United States in his day. And he said in 1960, "No one has ever been as well placed to harm the true church and to counteract its essential work as a priest in good standing. If such a man, by his preaching, teaching, or writing, actually sets forth the kind of teaching condemned in the anti-modernist documents of Lamentabili Sane or Prescendi Dominici Gregis, or if he works to discredit the loyal defenders of Catholic dogma, and does so without receiving any repudiation or reproof from those to whom the apostolic deposit of divine revelation has been entrusted, then the Catholic people are in grave danger of being deceived." How right he was. You know, August 29th, 2018, so just last week, there was an article posted over on LifeSite News. It says, "Father Richard Newhouse at epicenter of clergy sex abuse scandal is a grave negligence of bishops." Now, Father Newhouse passed away back in 2009, January 2009. He was a priest in the United States. He was the founder of First Things, a prolific pro-life activist, a renowned orator, an intellectual giant. And one thing that he was especially known for was his blunt articles on the church sexual abuse crisis back in 2002 and thereafter. And he went, you know, he went places where angels fear to tread and where bishops certainly refuse to go. And he repeatedly and correctly pinpointed the crisis as a problem of homosexuality and a crisis of grave negligence on the part of bishops, and one that was widespread, and because of widespread infidelity to the teaching of the church, particularly among the clergy, particularly among those who once upon a time were required to take that oath against modernism. Now, according to LifeSite News, quote, "With the revelations about Cardinal McCarrick, the Pennsylvania grand jury report, and Archbishop Vigano's explosive letter, Newhouse is being vindicated. On the sexual abuse scandals, Father Newhouse called the bishops to serious account for their negligence and their refusal to acknowledge the real causes of the scandal. And he wrote a great deal about how this was threatening to destroy the church in the West with a consequent loss to the entire culture. Newhouse stated in First Things, "Some still complain that the entire crisis was manufactured by the media and motivated by anti-Catholicism. But without the deeper crisis of the infidelity and negligence of bishops, the media could not have produced the public and consequently episcopal sense of this crisis. The scandal was in the chanceries, parishes, and seminaries before it was on the front page or on television news." And then he criticized the zero-tolerance policy of bishops. He said, quote, "Another name for the bishop's zero-tolerance policy, or the Dallas Charter, as it was known, is scapegoating. In setting themselves against their priests, the bishops have turned themselves into assistant district attorneys. This is not for the good of the church. This has nothing to do with the protection of children and young people. This is panic, and panic results in recklessness." Also, I agree with Father Newhouse, and at the time, I spoke out against the Dallas Charter zero tolerance policy because it's dangerous. I'll tell you why in a second. Father Newhouse said, The bishops have succeeded in scandalizing the faithful anew by adopting a thoroughly unbiblical, untraditional, and un-Catholic approach to sin and grace. They end up adopting a policy that is without repentance, without conversion, without forbearance, without prudential judgment, without forgiveness, without almost anything that one might have hoped for from the bishops of the Catholic Church. Not only that, but because of the zero tolerance aspect of the Dallas Charter policy, I personally know more than one priest who had it used against him just to silence him. Good Orthodox priests who had become a thorn in someone's side, and all they had to do was find somebody that was unbalanced and maybe wanted the attention to make an accusation, no matter how ludicrous, to shut these men up and to send them, you know, into the limbo of no ministry in the church. And you have to understand too that without a ministry in the church, the priests, they have no visible means of support. You know, and the church doesn't supply them with, canon lawyer, public defenders to take their case. That sort of, defending yourself against this kind of charge is lengthy and expensive and difficult. And a good many of them, just languish in this limbo outside of the active ministry of the church. And for no other reason than the bishop's zero tolerance policy, which didn't allow them to have their day in court. Now, the thing is, all of this stuff, and lots more, could have been written yesterday. And he was one of the few priests at the time who was really honest about the situation and really cared for the victims and for the church. And a lot of people read those articles, but they didn't act on them. And, the bishops circled the wagons to avoid the real problems. Not one bishop resigned. Not one was told to resign. Nobody was defrocked. The USCCB, with the John Jay report, didn't even acknowledge the obvious homosexual nature of the abuse or their own negligence that caused the problem to grow the way it did. And yet they, they're all boasting about their Dallas charter and their new procedures, and they're making me get fingerprinted and background checked by the FBI to teach RCIA for adults while this homosexual network continues to thrive and the infidelity among the clergy continued to grow. The LifeSite News article says, today the Lavender Mafia appears to have taken over even the Vatican itself. Now, there's a lot to say about this and about the reaction that we might have as faithful Catholics in the face of some pretty difficult stuff, some things that are pretty hard to swallow. And we're going to talk about that more when we come back. By the way, assuming the phone lines are working, you can give me a call here at 888-526-2151. Join the conversation. In the meantime, we will be back with lots more Happy Hour on Virgin Most Powerful Radio right after this.
This is Terry Barber encouraging you to go to CatholicRC.org. Take a look at all the CDs and the downloads from St. Joseph Communications. I have them all discounted on our website. And every time you purchase a CD, whether it's a download or a DVD, a portion of it goes right back to supporting the Terry and Jesse Show, because the profits come right back to our radio network. So I want to encourage you to go to CatholicRC.org. Also, while you're there, if you buy product from Amazon, go to Smile Amazon on our website, register the Catholic Resource Center as a beneficiary, because when you purchase anything from Amazon, a portion of it, they write us a check for that each quarter. And that's also going to support the Terry and Jesse Show. So pick up Scott Hahn, Tim Staples, Father Bill Casey. We've got the Spiritual Warfare Conferences for years to come. I think 4 or 5 years now of spiritual warfare conferences. All this is available on our website, CatholicRC.org. Download the material or purchase the CDs or the DVDs. Be inspired. Pass them on to friends. We're making these available to you. This is 40 years of my work of recording these conferences, and I want to make them available to you, whether you purchase them through a CD, a DVD, or a download. Share it with a friend or a family member. Let's bring a soul back to Christ and His church. That's CatholicRC.org or call us at 877-526-2151. May God richly bless you.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow, that's 80%. RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Happy Hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Now, here's Matthew.
Okay, welcome back to Happy Hour. Right here on Virgin, there I am, right here on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I want to give you an example now. We're talking about Father Richard Newhouse, God rest his soul, and how he reacted to the abuse crisis back when it first reared its ugly head in 2002. Now, he's been gone since 2009, but the things that he wrote pinpointing the cause of the crisis and the practical steps that needed to be taken in light of the crisis could have been written yesterday. And so I think he was quite prophetic, but it was just a matter of being willing to, you know, open your eyes and see what's really going on and understand that it needed to be dealt with. I just want to give you a sample of a few of the things that Father Newhouse wrote in his magazine, First Things. He said, "Let it be stated unambiguously, the leaders of the Catholic Church, meaning mainly the bishops, are responsible for the crisis and for the consequent frenzy." He's talking about the media frenzy. "The scandal is only very marginally about pedophilia. With very few exceptions, it is about adult men having sexual relations with adolescent and older teenage boys. Homosexuality is very close to the center of the crisis. At the epicenter is the grave negligence of bishops. Not all bishops, to be sure, but too many. The point is that this is a crisis, and this crisis must be permitted to do its work. That work involves scrupulous self-examination, candid confession, firm contrition, and believable amendment of life. And the doing of that hard work is chiefly up to the bishops. They are the ones who got us into this mess, and given what we believe is the divinely constituted structure of the church, they are the ones who have to lead in getting us out. Faithful Catholics owe it to the church and owe it to their bishops not to let them off the hook. In this instance, the virtue of docility includes a respect for bishops that requires recalling them to the duty and the dignity to which they were ordained. Too many of them have neglected that duty and debased that dignity. At the epicenter of the continuing crisis is the simple, however difficult, virtue of fidelity. What is this crisis about? The answer is that this crisis is about three things: fidelity, fidelity, and fidelity. The fidelity of bishops and priests to the teaching of the church and to their solemn vows, the fidelity of bishops in exercising oversight and ensuring obedience to that teaching and to those vows, and the fidelity of the lay faithful in holding bishops and priests accountable. So we have a role to play in this also. Now, friend, I often talk about the faith in terms of chivalry. So I want to share something from the work of Kenelm Digby, who wrote a four-volume opus on chivalry back in the 19th century called The Broadstone of Honor. And I have a little book here called Maxims of Christian Chivalry that's excerpts from that. And in the foreword that was written by a priest who, you know, compiled this, Nicholas Dillon, OFM, so he was a Franciscan, he writes in the foreword, quote, "There is an ideal for which true men live, and for which, if need were, they would die. Not to its profit do they look, or to any material gain that it can give. Its power over them comes not from pleasure, nor is ambition the secret mainspring of its strength. Without it, wealth has no worth, pleasure no charm, fame no fascination, success no crown. Without it, prosperity crumbles to the value of the dust, and all the finer flowers of human life wither beneath the breath of bitter but just contempt. With it, misfortune may become noble, suffering, worshipful, disaster, magnificent. It can give to trifles a preciousness greater than gold can buy. It can transform hardship into happiness, and round the worst failure, it can throw the glory of a true triumph. For, ideal though it be, it has a strange, practical power. It is the one test which inexorably unmasks the liar, the knave, or the animal amongst men, and which faithfully reveals the true, the good, and the noble. It is honor. Don't hear a whole lot about honor these days. Yet St. Thomas Aquinas tells us that honor is the greatest of the external goods which man can enjoy, much greater than wealth or power, for example. Honor, plainly speaking, is the due homage paid to genuine worth. But in human terms, I mean, inasmuch as all worth is from God, all of our gifts, everything good that we can offer to God come from him in the first place. Considering the fact that the only thing that we can lay claim to and say, this is mine and no one else's, is sin, you know, we have to understand that honor must really be referred to God and sought only for his sake or for the sake of the good of our neighbor. Right? Love of God and love of neighbor, that's the great commandment. And so honor, if we are to seek honor, which it isn't entirely right to seek honor, but only in so much as it refers to God and is sought for his sake. So you can see in the Douay Catechism of 1649, and this was written for English Catholics living under persecution after the Anglican Schism. It says, question 5, are we bound also to venture the ruin of our estates, the loss of our friends, and to lay down our very lives for the profession and defense of our faith? This isn't the first time in history that there's been something on the line in regard to your faith. Well, the answer to that question is yes. It says, doubtless we are, seeing the reward we expect in heaven infinitely exceeds all the pleasures and punishments of this life. And because Christ, the Son of the living God, has suffered far greater things for us, even to a disgraceful death on the cross. Therefore, it were base ingratitude in us not to be ready to give our lives for him as often as his honor shall require it. Don't hear much these days about the honor of God, and yet we are told right here in an official catechism of the Catholic Church that the honor of God is something for which you should lay down your life. You should be willing to lay down your life. You should be willing to risk everything for your own good, for the good of your neighbor, but first and foremost for the honor of God. And we have only to look to the example of our Lord Jesus Christ. You know, he had some harsh things to say about the Pharisees and the religious leaders of his day. He hated religious hypocrisy. He called the Pharisees a brood of vipers. He called them whitened sepulchres, which outwardly appear to men beautiful, but within are full of dead men's bones and of all filthiness. It's Matthew 23:27. He pronounced woes upon them for being religious hypocrites that preach but don't practice. But the only time that we know of that he got angry enough to upturn furniture and drive away men and animals alike with a whip made of cords was over the honor of God's house. Matthew 12:13, and he said unto them, it is written, my house shall be called the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves. And he was serious as a heart attack. You don't mess with the temple. You don't bring the profane into the house of God. Liturgical abuse is the one thing that made him angry enough to get physically violent. Now, I ran across an article the other day that actually, it really articulates a lot of things that I've been saying for a long time in kind of one condensed article. And I don't know if I'm going to have time to go over the whole thing today. But it's by Dr. Peter Kwasniewski. From the blog on LifeSite News on August 30th, and it's called The Connection Between Liturgical Abuse and the Abuse of Minors. And he starts off by saying that we all know good and holy priests, and priests who serve tirelessly and work for our salvation are part of the reason why being a Catholic is absolutely the greatest joy in the world. And we know that they're often underappreciated, and they are subject, especially at times like this, to undeserved skepticism and suspicion, because of the faults of some of their brethren. faults that they themselves would repudiate and condemn just as much as the laity do. You know, Our Lady of Good Success said 400 years ago that in this crisis, because of these, you know, the few depraved priests, that, you know, opprobrium was going to be cast upon all priests. But given the fact that there are many, many good priests, in fact, more good ones than bad ones, in my opinion, it's time to ask some hard questions. Especially Dr. Kwasniewski says, what's made it possible for so many quote-unquote men of God, including bishops, to become pawns of the devil? Apart from original sin, apart from the, you know, the danger of being corrupted by power, having your authority go to your head, he asks, can we identify any specific cause, you know, specific to the last 50 years, you know, which is the period in which the vast majority of clerical abuse cases were confined? And he puts his finger on it as a systemic cause of clerical deviation from duty, moral laxity, and debauchery is the atmosphere of, quote, Woodstockian lawlessness that accompanied the liturgical reforms and deformations of the 1960s and 70s, a time when unruly self-celebration replaced that Catholic ideal, not everywhere achieved, but everywhere required, of a priest who submitted himself to the discipline of a demanding liturgical form with its reverential rubrics and inculcation of the fear of God. A priest used to be a man consecrated to the strict and sober service of the sanctuary. As everything rapidly changed in these decades, he was suddenly the vernacular center of attention, the presider who manipulated the congregation. Priests were thrown into the lion's den of vanity, popularity, sentimentality, and relaxation, and not all were Daniels who escaped unscathed. There was no asceticism in sight. Whatever evil might have been suppressed by the former code of honor was now given free rein. So he puts it down to the fact that, yes, the liturgy, right? And Catholics of a certain age know what he's talking about. He says he can remember plenty of creative liturgies. And he says it's not surprisingly that the clergy responsible for such things were among those later investigated for moral corruption. He said it took him a long time to see the connection that the decades-long abuse of the Holy Mass and the rest of the sacramental and liturgical rites constitutes the first and fundamental form of clerical abuse of the laity, of which sexual abuse is a particular and more demented variety. So what he's saying is that liturgical abuse and sexual abuse differ in degree, but not in kind. Clerical sexual abuse is linked to clerical liturgical abuse, and sexual perversion is a mirror image of liturgical perversion. If, he asks, the highest and holiest thing in existence does not deserve our utmost veneration, why should mere human beings deserve any respect? It's an excellent question, and one that he takes on in some more detail, and we'll talk about that when we get back. And also, some good news about some good bishops who are stepping up in the face of this crisis. That and more when we come back with lots more Happy Hour right after this. Matthew Arnold here, host of Happy Hour on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. Part of our daily schedule of live 100% Catholic programs, along with the Terry and Jesse Show and the Bar of History with Dr. Ed Mazza. It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. This fall, Virgin Most Powerful Radio will be rolling out another original live program, Jesus 911 with Jesse Romero, Eddie Chavez, and Ruben Nava. Three ex-cops sharing true stories of evangelization and spiritual warfare on the streets of Los Angeles. We're also remodeling our studio and preparing to launch our new website and smartphone app. We desperately need to fix the bugs so you can listen live on our app or YouTube without any glitches. Plus, meet traditional broadcast standards in order to provide our exclusive programming to Catholic radio stations around the country and around the world, absolutely free of charge. As usual, we're doing it all on a shoestring budget. But we cannot do it without you. If you like what you hear on Virgin Most Powerful, I ask you to please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor.
You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Happy Hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Now, here's Matthew.
Okay, so we've been sharing from a article or a blog post, really, about the connection between liturgical abuse and the sexual scandal. And it's Dr. Peter Kwasniewski, who says that clerical abuse is linked to liturgical abuse. And, you know, that he says that liturgical abuse constitutes the first and fundamental form of clerical abuse of the laity. And he says if the highest and holiest thing in existence, meaning the Holy Mass, doesn't deserve our utmost veneration, and let's face it, we've all seen some crazy stuff in regard to the Holy Mass, not just the campfire music and the general informality, but and I don't want to rehearse it all here, but you know what I'm talking about. We really should, you know, this is the most beautiful, most dignified thing on earth, and it deserves our veneration. And if we don't show that veneration, we don't show the honor to God that he deserves, you know, then why should we think that human beings deserve any respect? You know, we're dust and ashes compared to the sacrifice on the altar, he says. On the other hand, if we profoundly reverence and fear Christ, true God and true man, we will acknowledge and care for his image in the souls and bodies of all human beings. Reverence for him goes hand in hand with respect for the little ones. Right? And I can understand that. How can you possibly be guilty of these things and give God the due reverence and honor? Now, he says, at times a Catholic feels the urge to say to liberal clergy the past five decades, you and your minions wrecked theology with modernism, you wrecked the liturgy with your reform, and as the coup de grace, you wrecked the lives of children. This is a ghastly inversion of the kingdom of God, and a time will come when all this evil is purged, and if not yet while there's still time for repentance, then assuredly when the Lord prepares for us a new heavens and a new earth. But, and I'm glad that he ends on this note, he says, we also say to our good and holy priests, keep doing what you're doing right. Love the sacred liturgy. Celebrate it with awe and devotion and fear and silence and beauty, and lead us with you eastwards in pilgrimage to the Lord. And that's a subtle reference to, you know, ad orientem worship, that the priests and the people face the east together. He says, remember and cherish our Catholic inheritance. He tells the priests, in this way you will bring about a real change in the culture of the Church, restoring the institution, its personnel, and its ceremonies to the honor that they deserve, restoration and honor. We're Catholics, we don't seek worldly honor. We esteem others before ourselves, but we give without hesitation all due honor to God and all due honor to Christ present in his minister at the altar, in the Blessed Sacrament, and when his ministers lead us in true worship. And we can do no less. You know, look, I know that scandals are disheartening, and the situation in the Church and the world is frankly becoming intolerable. But it's good that things are getting shaken up. It's good that signs of the restoration are happening. This is precisely what was predicted by Our Lady of Good Success in Quito, Ecuador, 400 years ago, and at Fatima, and at Akita, and on and on. This is we are entering the reign of Mary. We are looking forward to the Immaculate, the triumph of her Immaculate Heart. These things are being fulfilled before your very eyes. This is a terrific time to be alive, and this is when God wanted you to be alive. You know, back in 2002, I visited Scott Hahn in Steubenville, Ohio. We were doing a radio show together at that time, and in fact, it was on that visit was the only time we were ever physically in the same place during a broadcast, because normally he was in Ohio and I was out here on the coast. And this one time we did the show together, and we had dinner with his family, and we went out in the backyard to just have a chat just between the two of us. And I don't know that I've ever shared this publicly before, But we were talking about the scandal and just how deep it was and how widespread we were discovering. And he got this look on his face, looked like somebody punched him in the stomach. And I said, Scott, are you okay? You know, what is it? And he looked at me and said, I just realized that I'm probably not going to live to see the restoration of the church. But look at what's happening right now. Because the signs are there. Let me share just a couple of things with you. Archbishop Chaput just stated in a letter to Pope Francis that they should call off the upcoming synod on the youth because, quote, the bishops will have absolutely no credibility, unquote. He said instead the Pope should spend the resources on a type of retraining program for the bishops. Now, first off, it's not the youth that need the most help right now, and surely they are not the ones to lead us out of this crisis by telling the bishops what they do or do not want to accept regarding the teaching of the church. You know, and Archbishop Chaput is not alone in speaking up. We got 10 bishops and counting that have publicly given their support in the last week to Archbishop Vigano's character and the credibility of the testimony that he gave in his letter. So Archbishop Charles Chaput in Philadelphia said that what he said about the synod, but he also vouched for the former nuncio's character, saying he, quote, found his service to be marked by integrity to the church. Bishop Thomas J. Papraki, however you say that, of Springfield, Illinois, said, given the gravity of the content and implications of the former nuncio's statement, it is important for all the facts of the situation to be fully reviewed, vetted, and carefully considered. Archbishop Samuel J. Aquila of Denver cited Cardinal DiNardo's from USCCB, the president, in a statement which included, quote, the questions raised deserve answers that are conclusive and based on evidence. Without those answers, innocent men may be tainted by false accusation, and the guilty may be left to repeat the sins of the past. Now we have Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, who went so far as to order all the priests in his diocese to read from the pulpit a statement that he finds Vigano's allegations credible. Archbishop Cordiglione of San Francisco, in an open letter to his faithful, said, quote, I can attest that Archbishop Vigano is a man who served his mission with selfless dedication, who fulfilled well the Petrine mission entrusted to him. Bishop Thomas Olmsted of Phoenix issued a statement affirming that he has known Vigano for 39 years and, quote, has always known and respected him as a man of truthfulness, faith, and integrity, and that his testimony should be, quote, taken seriously by all, unquote. And then we have Archbishop Alan Vigneron of Detroit, Michigan, who issued a statement calling Vigano's account, quote, another daunting challenge to our confidence in the reliability of the church's leadership during a summer of devastating news regarding clergy, sexual abuse, and infidelity, unquote. Bishop Athanasius Schneider, we went over this in some detail last week, said, quote, Archbishop Vigano confirmed his statement by a sacred oath invoking the name of God. There is, therefore, no reasonable and plausible cause to doubt the truth content of the document of Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano. See, here's a guy that understands honor, who says, I know that Archbishop Vigano didn't lie because he took an oath to God that what he was saying is true, and there's no reason to doubt him. And then we have Cardinal Raymond Burke, and a statement that said, quote, the declarations made by a prelate of the authority of Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano must be totally taken to heart by those responsible in the church. And then we have now, I just read this morning, Bishop Frank Caggiano of Bridgeport, Connecticut, made a request effective September 15th, the Feast of Our Lady of Sorrows, on which day he will lead a holy hour and a mass of reparation along with all the priests of his diocese. Not only that, I mean, he's making reparation with the holy sacrifice of the Mass. There isn't a higher thing, a more important thing that he could do than to offer the holy sacrifice of the Mass, to do so in reparation and to do so with, you know, by requiring the presence of all his clergy, of all the priests. He couldn't make a more powerful statement. And he asked that the St. Michael prayer be recited after every Mass beginning that day, and he exhorted the lay Catholics to, quote, pray it personally as well. You know, Pope Leo XIII composed the St. Michael prayer and requested that it be said after all low masses. In fact, they had the, what they call the prayers after low mass, which included the Hail Holy Queen and three Hail Marys and the prayer to Saint Michael. Of course, in, back in the day, there was a distinction between low mass and the high mass. You know, you had Missa Cantata, sung mass, and you had solemn high mass, and so forth. But the low mass, you know, the mass that you just had on a typical Sunday or holy day of obligation, he asked that these prayers and the prayer of St. Michael be recited after each one of those. And why? He wrote that prayer and asked it to be said in order to combat the diabolical influence of the heresy of modernism, which is still our problem, and to see that practice restored, even if it's only in one diocese. That can only be a sign of the restoration of the church. And in the face of all of this, and to bring this back around to the conversation I had with Scott Hahn back in 2002, I'm happy to report that Scott has taken to social media to thank the Bishop of Tyler, Texas, for supporting Archbishop Vigano's testimony about ex-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. He actually posted a message, thank you, you know, thank you, Bishop Strickland. He posted a link to LifeSite News translation of Vigano's statement with the message, seems like a good time to pray like never before. And he also posted to a link to a National Catholic Register story about Vigano's letter with the message, wow, Lord have mercy. Right? So he's sharing that these things that are coming out. And I think that it's heartening, because maybe he will live to see the restoration of the church. Maybe we will too. I hope so. I know that we're seeing, if you have the eyes of faith, you can see that the restoration of the church is underway, that it is going to happen, that we don't need to worry about the future of the church in the sense that the gates of hell would prevail against it, because we have Christ's promise that that's not going to happen. And that's one of the reasons that I've asked everybody to take the oath against modernism. I'm so pleased that everybody here at Virgin Most Powerful, all the other hosts, have embraced it. And I've already noticed, you know, we haven't done much in the way of promotion on this. I've been mentioning it on my show, and we've done this today, and I think we sent out an email late last night, but there have already been dozens and dozens of people coming to the website to take the oath against modernism and to sign their names and to be included on that list that Terry and Jesse are going to take to the Bishops' Conference. That's an excellent sign. That's, you know, you are a sign of the restoration of the church. The fact that you're listening to this program right now, the fact that you care about what's happening, that's a sign of the restoration of the church. And so I urge you to prayerfully consider going to Virgin Most Powerful website, vmpr.org, and take that oath against modernism. And do not forget that now is a great time to be Catholic. Now we're starting to see the pendulum swing back. And that's what we're going to be talking about this week. We're going to be talking about some of the causes and the motives behind what's happened, and how we're going to be able to see light at the end of the tunnel, and what you and I can do about it. Because that's the thrust. Sharing the truth in clarity and charity, but without compromise, that's what Virgin Most Powerful is all about. And so thank you for listening, and I invite you to tune in again tomorrow. Don't forget to tune in 9 a.m. Pacific time for Jesus 911 with Jess Romero, Eddie Chavez, and Ruben Nava. And also that Dr. Ed Maza is now on at 10 a.m. Bar of History at 10, right before Terry and Jesse show, and then happy hour with yours truly. All right. In the meantime, hang in there, and may God richly bless you and your family.
Prayer is a conversation, and a conversation goes two ways. We speak and we listen. But how do we listen to God? Do we look for signs? I just saw a leaf blow across the street. Am I supposed to leaf my boyfriend? I guess God can use signs, but for the most part, He speaks more simply than that, through Scripture. Every day, before anything else gets into your head, I want you to start by opening the Gospel According to iPhone. It's all right there. Just Google Gospel from Daily Mass. It's really short. Read it. Ask God what He's saying to you through His Word, and then talk to Him from your heart. Make that a daily habit, because if it's not, it'll never happen. Now, you might be thinking, I'm not a monk. I can't pray every morning. Look, I know you're not. That's why I'm only asking you for something that takes about 2 minutes. And if you do that every day, I promise you, it will change your life. This is Chris Stefanik from RealLifeCatholic.com.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.